Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. This is WNYC FM HD and AM New York, WNJT FM 88.1 Trenton, WNJP 88.5 Sussex, WNJY 89.3 Netcong, and WNJO 90.3 Toms River. We are New York and New Jersey Public Radio at 10:59. If you believe reality itself is engaged in an epic existential battle right now, if you're trying not to feel helpless as the truth is trampled into dust, has Brooke Gladstone got a book for you? It's an 87-page essay called The Trouble with Reality, A Rumination on Moral Panic in Our Time. In this little book that you can practically read on one long subway ride, Brooke draws on the wisdom of so many people: Hannah Arendt, Walter Lippmann, George Orwell, Philip K. Dick, Ursula K. Le Guin, and Jonathan Swift, to name a few, to help us understand what the heck is going on with this twisted moment in our history. I won't bore you by trying to describe it more than that. Let's just hear from Brooke Gladstone, host and managing editor of On the Media, and now the author of The Trouble with Reality, A Rumination on Moral Panic in Our Time. Hi, Brooke, and congratulations. This is awesome.
Thank you. Thank you. You know, the book is so small. I should have said a rumination on more on existential panic in our time, because people don't really understand what moral panic means. It sounds like it's panic over morality, but actually it is about the nature of life itself. It's a kind of false cognate. And people think that I'm drawing moral lessons in the title, which I'm not. I do it later on a little bit, but not there.
Well, there are so many places we could start, but let's enter here. You compare the two classic books, 1984 by George Orwell and Brave New World by Aldous Huxley, through the lens of the late NYU media studies professor Neil Postman. Mm-hmm. Both those books describe totalitarian worlds we could find ourselves in, but one of them struck Postman as more relevant to today, and I think struck you that way too. Will you take us there?
Sure, absolutely. Postman was writing about this in his 1985 classic book, Amusing Ourselves to Death, which still has a great deal to teach us, even though it does precede the internet and the impact of digital technology. And I think some of the things that he projects are off. But in terms of the Orwell-Huxley comparison, here's what he wrote. He wrote, What Orwell feared were those who would ban books. What Huxley feared was that there would be no reason to ban a book, for there would be no one who wanted to read one. Orwell feared those who would deprive us of information. Huxley feared those who would give us so much information that we would be reduced to passivity and egoism. Orwell feared that the truth would be concealed from us. Huxley feared that the truth would be drowned in a sea of irrelevance. Orwell feared that we would become a captive culture. Huxley feared that we would become a trivial culture, preoccupied with the equivalent of the feelies, the orgy-porgy, and the centrifugal bumble puppy. In 1984, Orwell added, people are controlled by inflicting pain. In Brave New World, they are controlled by inflicting pleasure. In short, Orwell feared that what we hate will ruin us. Huxley feared that what we love will ruin us.
It was that last one that really stopped me short in my tracks when I was reading the book. In 1984, Orwell added, people are controlled by inflicting pain. In Brave New World, they're controlled by inflicting pleasure. And it's that that you say was the world that led us ineluctably to the election of Donald Trump.
Absolutely. How could it be otherwise? I mean, Trump's campaign was an endless stream of comedy and melodrama, apocalypse and deliverance. It was incredibly entertaining, no matter what your politics were. To some, it was enthrallingly frank, I wrote. But to others, ultimately, Trump's victory shattered reality. And it was much more than about a political outcome you didn't like or a president you didn't respect or even feared. If you live long enough, you're bound to have those experiences many times over your life. And you can feel a kind of dread. But what I was hearing in our Eastern elite bubble, in our cohort, and basically from cities all around the country, because it seems to be a city-country thing even more than a policy or a party thing, was that this sense of dread was more extreme, more chilling, more disabling, because it got to the core of our beliefs of how the world worked. And so I decided to, you know, take a deep dive into trying to figure out exactly how do we construct the worlds we live in? Why do we construct those worlds? Is it even possible to see past the boundaries of our own infinite bubbles? And I honestly think it isn't like there are two in this country. I think there are as many bubbles as there are individuals. They are bespoke. They are handcrafted. And we craft them for a reason. And we've been doing it for as long as we've existed.
Another reference from the book. You quote the English poet John Milton, most famous for Paradise Lost, in a polemic against censorship to the British government in the 1700s that inspired Thomas Jefferson. Mm-hmm. But I think you now find it naive.
Right, yeah. Well, here's the thing, is that what Milton said and what Jefferson later echoed was that if you place truth in a battle with falsehood, truth will always win. Milton believed that the people fundamentally grew wise with exposure to information. And Jefferson certainly believed this. Now, not all the founding fathers did. Madison didn't really believe it. Hamilton certainly didn't. And the fact is that we know now that information does not lead to a higher truth. We create our worlds from the seen and the unseen. The seen are the facts, but until they are marinated in our traditions and our values, until we place them into a narrative context that we agree with, all of those things, and we leave out the ones that don't fit, information alone won't do it. Fact-checking alone won't stop Trump. The only way to stop Trump, if you want to stop Trump, is to make sure that those facts can fit into the lives of people who don't agree with you. In other words, you have to place them in a context, you have to explain their relevance, and then you have to wait. Yes, you have to wait for the world to bear you out.
But if the argument in the 1700s that inspired Jefferson and others was that censorship is bad because more information leads to good political decision making. Mm-hmm. Well, we certainly have more information in today's world than we've ever had before, and there is no shortage of bad political decision making. But are you suggesting that some of the very best values of our nation, because the First Amendment was based on this idea, are based on utopian wishful thinking and are bound to fail us?
Well, what are values? Values are our better angels. They don't necessarily reflect what's in the real world. But we have to understand that these are not mechanical principles. This is not physics. This is philosophy. We want to believe that information will make us better people, a more informed electorate, as Jefferson would say. But many people, including John Adams, and I quote him towards the end of the book, he says, remember, democracy never lasts long. It soon wastes, exhausts, and murders itself. The passions are the same in all men under all forms of simple government, and when unchecked, produce the same effects of fraud, violence, and cruelty. Individuals have conquered themselves, nations and large bodies of men never. In other words, we believe it is a liberal principle. It is one of our foundational beliefs that Democracy is the best system, and democracy works. And what did we see in this election? A sense that it didn't work, that something went wrong. And I examine the role of the press. I examine the masterful use of alternate forms of information and actually casting doubt on the very possibility of knowing reality. I mean, when Trump says that all of the organs of accountability, whether it's the Congressional Budget Office or the media, are simply other special interest groups with their own agenda, and that you don't believe them, you shouldn't believe them, you don't have to believe them, you can pick who you want to believe based on absolutely nothing more than your inclination, because the truth cannot be known. The truth, if you support me, is what I say it is today, and whatever I say it is tomorrow, support me too, because I've made you some promises, and that's our deal, right? And so that's what we're confronted with. This is different from the Bush administration, which many people threw their hands up at, because they were offering an alternate reality. But it was a consistent one and a stable one. It was Karl Rove who told the New York Times reporter Ron Suskind that you and the reality-based community have to understand that we're going to be throwing realities at you as we choose, and you're just going to have to deal with that. But the departure for Trump is that he is throwing at us the idea that there is no reality, or that it's optional, just build your own.
Our On the Media host and managing editor, Brooke Gladstone, with us with her brand new book, The Trouble with Reality, A Rumination on Moral Panic in Our Time. And I just want to mention that our spring pledge drive kicks off tomorrow, but today we're dipping our toe into the fundraising waters.
Talk about reality.
We had our successful power hour this morning, whereby we raised a full day's worth of money in 1 hour. Thank you so much if you participated in that. The drive will be one full day shorter as a result. And right now, we have an extra special pre-pledge drive offer in honor of Brooke as our guest today and the publication of her new book, The Trouble with Reality. We have a special offer right now when you make a sustaining contribution of $15 a month to WNYC. We have 120 signed copies to give away this hour to the first 120 listeners to call 888-376-WNYC. 888-376-9692, or go to WNYC.org. 120 Brooke Gladstone signed copies of The Trouble with Reality. They're like, you know, these are like Derek Jeter autographs. You can sell them on eBay. And, I don't know.
Just like Derek Jeter. I want to believe.
The most interesting part of your book for me, I think, was the Hannah Arendt section.
Mm.
Hannah Arendt, the Hitler and Stalin era political theorist, who said would-be totalitarian rulers usually start their careers by boasting of their past crimes and carefully outlining their future ones. That is so Trumpian, it's creepy. And she
mm-hmm.
wrote that in 1951?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she did, in a book chillingly titled The Origins of Totalitarianism. Now, I want to say that I am not comparing Trump to Hitler or his followers to Nazis. I am talking purely about Arendt's description of how the Nazis, and particularly Hitler, used the engines of media, used rhetoric, and spoke to a disaffected population that had been ignored for generations, or at least a really bad generation of being ignored, in order to create an immense constituency. And the kinds of rhetoric that was used bear such strong parallels to what we saw in the past election. Again, I'm not saying to the same end. I'm simply saying the techniques are really illustrative, and they're worth taking a look at. And she took a very close look and missed nothing.
So you're right that once again, the so-called carnival barker seized a mallet and smashed an essential stereotype that our democracy was based on a set of shared values. You mean we couldn't even agree as a nation that these things most New Yorkers found hateful were even bad?
The thing is that there was a bargain. I think that if you said, do we believe that everyone is equal, probably everyone in the country would believe that. But what they see with their eyes is a sense of being ignored while all the media attention is on, you know, immigrants and people in the inner city being shot. And, hey, what about us? We're here. We don't have jobs. We're dying at higher rates from opioid addiction and gun violence and so on. It's a sense that there's complete chaos, and there's also a sense, I believe, of entitlement, that they deserve this attention before it goes to anybody else, especially any recent immigrants to the United States. And here's the thing. I'm not saying listen to these people, understand them, see if you can find some common ground. No, I'm not saying that. You have values. I have values. I will cling to them. I have to have them and hold fast to them. But all I know is that many of our fundamental beliefs about how things work got smashed. And if you want to ease that sense of unsettlement, then you have to figure out how to paste your world back together, create a more durable reality. And the only way you can do that is if you figure out what actually happened and why, and that necessitates going out and listening to what people say.
Another Hannah Arendt. Did you say
Arendt?
Arendt. I've always said Hannah Arendt, but that's probably from total ignorance.
I don't know if I'm saying it right.
Hannah Arendt. I'm going with yours. Another Hannah Arendt quote you include is, the spokesmen for totalitarian movements possessed an unerring instinct for anything that ordinary party propaganda or public opinion did not care to touch. The mob really believed the truth was whatever respectable society had hypocritically passed over or covered with corruption. And the modern masses do not believe in anything visible. What convinces masses are not facts, and not even invented facts, but only the consistency of the system of which they are presumably part. So creepily eerie to what we're seeing now, or as you deeply analyze it in the book, yikes.
Well, the thing is, you know, I was uncomfortable with her using the term masses, although it was much more commonly used both for the right and the left. I mean, one great left-wing magazine was called the Modern Masses, yeah. I believe, or the Masses. But in this case, she's talking about the followers of Hitler. But I think that we all long for consistency in our positions, and we are all loath to change. And there is a whole lot of interesting data that suggests that, because our realities are built on a web of beliefs. Fundamentally, they have found there was a study of visitors to a site about climate change, and it was a well-conducted study, and they found that people who had a strong belief in the free market did not have a strong belief in climate change. Well, you can imagine why. There's a relationship there. They also didn't have a strong belief in HIV causing AIDS. They also didn't have a strong belief in smoking causing cancer. All of these things can be traced back to this strong foundational belief in the free market. You can't have that and science happening at the same time if one is going to call the other one into challenge. That is that web of beliefs I'm talking about. And don't think this just happens on the right.
So you describe a classic authoritarian deal that Trump made to his followers. And I think you were just mm-hmm. alluding to this. Mm-hmm. And again, not to suggest in you quoting Hannah Arendt that Trump wants to be Hitler or wants to be Stalin, but it's still a classic authoritarian deal mm-hmm. in type with his supporters. You write, you can bask in my favor and recognition, in the promises I make and the license I bestow. And all I ask in return is that you believe whatever I say whenever I say it, even when it is false, even when it contradicts the reality of your own experience. Arendt saw that in her time, too.
Right. Absolutely. And why? Because if you catch me in a lie tomorrow, it doesn't matter. You'll just wink. You're in on the joke. Because the facts really don't matter. Because, as I said, the truth is a liar.
Do you think anyone ever said, I take Hitler seriously but not literally?
Well, we certainly know that the coverage of Hitler was very derisive and no one took him seriously for until it was too late.
Brooke Gladstone, our On the Media host and managing editor, is now the author of The Trouble with Reality, A Rumination on Moral Panic in Our Time, and we'll continue with Brooke in just a minute. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with Brooke Gladstone, host and managing editor of On the Media, here with her new book, The Trouble with Reality, A Rumination on Moral Panic in Our Time. And listeners, we can take your calls for Brooke Gladstone on the ideas in her book. And I want to get, you know, a little away from the politics of right now and today's news and stick with the big ideas in this big idea book, The Trouble with Reality, A Rumination on Moral Panic in Our Time. So if you've been listening to Brooke and want to enter this conversation, enter wherever you like at 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. If you too believe that reality itself is engaged in an epic existential battle right now, how do you cope to not descend into moral panic? If you're trying not to feel helpless as the truth is trampled into dust, how do you fight back? Or anything else you want to say or ask or respond to that Brooke has been saying, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And I will just mention again that as sort of a pre-membership drive special, we have 120 signed copies of Brooke's book to give away this hour to the first 120 listeners to become sustaining contributors at the $15 a month level to WNYC at 888-376-WNYC, 888-376-9692, or go to WNYC.org and do it there. 120 signed copies of Brooke Gladstone's The Trouble with Reality, A Rumination on Moral Panic in Our Time, and that's all the pledge driving we're doing today, just that. So 120 of those for those of you who want to pledge $15 a month to WNYC at WNYC.org. The pledge drive starts for real tomorrow. So there is just one quote that I noticed you used twice in the book.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me why this is that important. It's from Walter Lippmann, the mm-hmm. newspaper man from 100 years ago. And he says in the 1920s, it says, if the newspapers are to be charged with the duty of translating the whole public life of mankind so that every adult can arrive at an opinion on every moot topic, they fail. They are bound to fail. In any future one can conceive, they will continue to fail. Since I mangled that, I'm going to read it again. If the newspapers are to be charged with the duty of translating the whole public life of mankind so that every adult can arrive at an opinion on every moot topic, they fail. They are bound to fail. In any future one can conceive, they will continue to fail. Fail at what?
To really grab hold of the people and to inform them. The reason why it appears in two places, Brian, is because in the early part of the book, I talk about one of our foundational beliefs that was shattered, which is that information will lead to wisdom. Because it's foundational because our founding fathers did believe it, and they created laws in order to that were based entirely on that, that are uniquely American. The First Amendment, obviously, exists because the founding fathers were convinced that wisdom emerged from information. They codified civil liberties to ensure that our speech and press were free. But the thing is that even though it saw the press as a vital institution, it didn't support it like a vital institution. It was still a business. And as Lippmann complained in the 20s, people don't like to pay for information. Even then, they like to pay for entertainment. And it was entertainment that kept the presses rolling, and it was entertainment that became the tail that was wagging the dog of actual useful information. And then I used it again because we jump ahead to now, and we see a time, a great moment that I think many in the media have been waiting for since Craigslist began and since newspapers started posting their information online for free, which is that if you want high-quality information, if you want information that you can trust from people that you trust, even if they do make mistakes sometimes, then you have to pay for it. This is an idea that went entirely out of fashion. We've always been able to pay for entertainment. When I was a kid, TV was free. Now we all pay for TV. We pay to be entertained, mostly. And, I mean, it's ESPN that makes the most money. So in this case, people...
And even they just had a lot of people off.
Well, there you go.
Because everything's going to the web.
We have increasingly moved towards free information, where we can get it, no matter what the quality is. We'll just grab it and consume it like entertainment, something else Neil Postman worried about back in the 80s. But now we realize we have to pay for it. And as a result, ailing great news organizations are staffing up. The Times, The Post, public radio is stronger, I think, than it's ever been. Certainly WNYC has been the beneficiary of listeners realizing that they need this stuff. They want this stuff. And I repeated it again because right now the media have taken on Trump with the strength of the people who are supporting them, their audience. And should the audience fall away, then that engine of accountability will run out of gas again, and it will just sputter into disuse, and there won't be any engines of accountability. Right now, the trust in the media is so low in Republican echo chambers. I think it's down to 14%. I think it's 51% among Democrats.
So the second time you use the Lippmann quote, it's in the context of the Washington media growing a spine in the era of Trump, as you were just laying out. Information, investigation, clarity, less giving equal weight to false equivalencies for the sake of looking balanced.
Mm-hmm.
But you wonder whether Lippmann would laugh or cheer or cry. Why?
Well, he was cynical about the prospects of the media carrying the whole load. He said the problem isn't just that the media is a business. The problem is that the other institutions of accountability in the government, the ones that are supposed to generate data and keep us informed, don't work very well. And of course, under the current president, a lot of the organizations that produced data, you know, ranging from the EPA to the Congressional Budget Office, have been hobbled. So we'll be seeing less and less data. The Census Bureau chief recently left. That's a disaster. It's not something we're going to go into here, but the fact is that is information that absolutely strengthens our democracy, and all you have to do is choke off the funds, and there that goes. The media can't carry that whole load. Now, I have to say that something that wasn't around in Lippmann's time was data journalism and computer and digital technology. The media can pick up more than that. But again, it is expensive.
There's a cliche that used to feel like an act of resistance. It was the internet wants to be free.
Yeah.
So, on the one side, open source values versus the corporatization of the web, yes. But on the other side, journalism is dying in the post-newspaper world because the internet has no business model. Yeah.
Information wants to be free meant unfettered. It didn't mean without a price.
Let's take a call. TJ in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, TJ.
Hello. Your programs are wonderful, as usual. My congratulations.
Thank you.
I want to say what I think about objective reality in regards to what Gail Collins said in your last hour. Her objective assessment of our times is that we must accept Trump's going to be with us for a long time. That was her objective assessment, objective reality. And I do believe that there is objective reality in the world, and I do think that everybody knows this man ought to be impeached. But I think we have accepted surrender. When we hear people like Gail Collins say, well, he's going to be around a long time, we have to accept it. That is a very bad objective reality proposal to give to this country. There ought to be people marching in the streets by the millions, and that's what she should have said. That is a more active attack. Are you still there?
Yeah.
Yes, yes. I'm waiting for you to get to something relevant to Brooke. I think Gail was saying that he's likely to be around for a long time because it's unlikely that he'll be impeached and actually removed from office. But let's.
I don't think she was saying stay home, don't express your outrage, don't express your political views. I think she was giving her assessment of what the future is likely to be. It wasn't a call to inaction. It was simply a cold-eyed look at, you know, how she assessed the mood in Washington among the GOP right now.
Claire in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with Brooke Gladstone. Hi, Claire.
Hi, Brian, and hi, Brooke. Thank you so much for taking my call. I really love and appreciate both your shows so much.
Thank you.
I just wanted to say, apropos of that, that, I mean, it's more of a sort of requote from Tocqueville, whose insight was that revolutions are sort of produced by rising expectations and improved conditions, not by mass immiseration. And so there is this subtle or not so subtle undermining and what that means for, you know, activism and even people's just ability to act.
Well, you know, there, Tocqueville, he was brilliant and very quotable, but I think that we see revolutions rising expectations in the midst of declining lifestyles. So it's not that, gee, I want what he has, we'll have a revolution. It's more that the injustice that he has, what I don't have. And often it is unjust. I mean, in our country where income inequality seems to grow with every financial quarter, it is, but amazingly enough, people do believe another foundational myth that anyone, if they work hard enough, can make it, or at least enough people believe that, even though it is a myth, that that will probably forestall revolution.
Kevin in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with Brooke Gladstone. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Thanks for having me. I love both of your shows.
Thank you.
Thanks.
I decided to renew my membership when I heard about Brooke's book this morning, and I really like the premise of the book. And I just had a question for Brooke. I wanted to ask, what do you see as the different realities within the Democratic Party, meaning kind of the Bernie camp and, the traditional, the Hillary supporter and kind of the backlash of the Bernie or bust movement?
Well, you know, I think that there's a belief all across the political spectrum in systems. And I think that we heard from a lot of the Bernie or bust people, I'm thinking of Susan Sarandon, for instance, that if you make the system unendurable, it will come crashing down, and something better, fairer will rise in its place. That's why after Bernie didn't make it, she was, you know, she said, you know, it wouldn't be so bad if there were Trump, because Trump would send everything crashing down. If Bernie can't power it through, then we'll have Trump just blow it up, which is what a number of Trump followers were saying. We've gotten nothing but empty promises every 4 years, and you forget about us, and we've had it. We are mad as hell, and we won't take it anymore. So there is that. But in terms of specific, I think that there were just some people who believed, and there's enough history out there to show that there wasn't enough of a progressive push among the mainstream Democratic contingent. And certainly the Clintons have had their issues. The welfare reform in the Clinton days was very bad for poor people, ultimately. And although many people believed it would be good, there were some who warned that what would happen did happen, including Daniel Patrick Moynihan. And then he was pushing on the issue of putting pressure on poor countries to buy name brand HIV drugs instead of making their generics, which was also just a sop to Big Pharma. I mean, you could look at history and go, we can do better. But the thing is you have to balance the costs of such purity.
Kevin, thanks for your call. If you're just joining us, let me reset for a second. Our guest is the host and managing editor of On the Media, Brooke Gladstone, who has a new book called The Trouble with Reality, A Rumination on Moral Panic in Our Time. And this is an 87-page essay that's, you know, it's a little book that you can practically read on one long subway ride, but in which Brooke draws on the wisdom of so many cultural and literary figures from the last few centuries. Hannah Arendt, who we were just talking about before, Walter Lippmann, who we were talking about, George Orwell, Philip K. Dick, Ursula K. Le Guin, Jonathan Swift, and we'll get to the Gulliver's Travels references with which you end the book in a little while, to name a few, to help us understand what the heck is going on with this twisted moment in our history. I will mention again that we're offering, as we ease into our pledge drive, which will start in earnest tomorrow, 120 signed copies of Brooke's book to give away this hour to the first 120 listeners to go to WNYC.org right now and become a sustaining member of WNYC at the $15 a month level at WNYC.org, or you can call our pledge line at 888-376-WNYC, 888-376-9692. 120, I don't know how many are gone and how many are left, but it's 120 signed copies to give away just this hour. Brooke Gladstone's autograph in this cool little paperback that you can carry around and read. And, you know, if you need to, sort of like the political philosophy of the last 400 years in 87 pages and how it relates to the election of Donald Trump, this is it, WNYC.org, if you want one signed copy for a $15 a month sustaining membership. Thank you all for considering it. All right, back into the content. David in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, David.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I find this conversation intriguing, and I think it, all of the people mentioned, have read, in fact, two of them in particular. We all know 1984, and we know Brave New World and Hannah Arendt, etc. But it seems that two of the most important people were Walter Lippmann, who, if I remember correctly, I saw his later columns in the Herald Tribune, mm-hmm. And also Neil Postman, who, of course...
Right, and of course, and I'm going to try to get you to your point, David. Of course, yes, we were just talking about the Neil Postman and the Walter Lippmann references and relationships to what's going on today that Brooke draws in her book. You wanted to say something about Lippmann in particular, David? Is that what you told our screener?
Oh, I think he was right on. And I also think that Postman was right on. And yet, it seems that everything has to be repeated over and over, and nothing is remembered.
I know. It is amazing. Partly because we seem to create our own worlds almost from scratch. We get some things handed down. But interestingly, one of my big discoveries was that it was Walter Lippmann who introduced the idea of stereotypes in the psychological sense. Back in the 20s, in his book Public Opinion, he said that what we do is we pick up a salient detail about a person or a group. Are they black or white? Is he a banker or a kindergarten teacher? Do they live in Brooklyn or Baton Rouge? And then we blithely fill in the rest of the blanks, and we think that we know them. And our worldview is built on bedrock of precisely these stereotypes, not just about people, but also about ideas. We can't live without them. The world, as Lippmann said, is altogether complex, too complex for us to understand in its entirety. So our lives are engaged much more in filtering out information rather than integrating information.
So it was Walter Lippmann, a journalist, rather than Freud or somebody who came up with the idea of stereotypes?
Yeah. And he said that stereotypes, they focus and feed on the familiar and what is exotic, and they exaggerate both. So if you see somebody who's a little bit like you, for your purposes of stereotyping, they are exactly like you. And if you see somebody who's kind of different from you in a particular way, then you think they are entirely different from you. And these notions are constantly refreshed, sometimes by close, genuine observation, and sometimes by completely false analogy. And we walk around with these things. I think another term for them, these shortcuts, is heuristics. They enable us to negotiate our world. And without them, we would be paralyzed.
So to exemplify this idea, I pulled a clip from On the Media from way back in 2006.
Wow.
That you refer to in the book. It's it's you with Emory University professor Drew Weston. Mm-hmm. On selective outrage and how it flows from our stereotyping of other people. And Weston, in this one-minute clip, is describing people's brains when people they either agree with or disagree with politically say something scandalous or threatening.
The first thing that was activated were a series of negative emotion circuits that were basically, for any of your listeners who can remember Lost in Space, it was Will Robinson, danger, danger. They saw danger, they saw threat, and you could see it all over their brains. Then what you saw was activation in a part of the brain called the anterior cingulate. It monitors and deals with conflict. So you could see that they were in conflict. They were trying to figure out a way out of that conflict. And then you saw, after they had come to their conclusion that there was really no problem for their guy, what you saw was activation in parts of the brain that are very rich in the neurotransmitters that are involved in reward. These are the circuits in the brain that get activated when junkies get their fix.
You mean once they figured out how best to lie to themselves, they got a blast of oxytocin or something?
Very, very close. That's right. So they got this huge blast of dopamine, which is involved in reward.
In other words, the same thing you get when you take Coke.
That's exactly right. There was no reasoning at all going on.
Huh. So that was when somebody who is in your political party.
Right. When they say something that you really suspect is dishonest or sleazy, you know, if somebody who's not in your party does that, your reasoning sections in your brain light up. But if somebody in your own party does that, the distress area lights up. And until you figure out how to either dismiss or integrate this material in some sort of way, you will be in horrible distress. Once you integrate it or you figure out how to dismiss it, you lie to yourself, then you get your shot of dopamine. We are wired to lie to ourselves to keep our worlds consistent. That's the point.
That's the trouble with reality. Levi in Brooklyn, a psychologist. You're on WNYC. Hi, Levi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I love your show.
Thank you.
You know, there's a saying, a famous saying, I see it all the time when I'm dealing with individuals. There's his truth, there's her truth, and then there's the actual truth, you know? And I think you personify that greatly, especially with your guests on the show talking about the psychological aspects and backgrounds of confirmation bias. And I agree with it 100%. I just have a trouble, and I think everyone has this issue, where how do we come to a realization of real objective truth when all we're doing is we're hardwired to see our way? So take the liberal media. They are saying that Trump is a less than ideal candidate, no question. But everyone still called that Hillary Clinton would win the election, and that was, in one word, two words, confirmation bias. But we're not having those conversations from both angles. So there's selective moral outrage at the right, but where's the selective moral outrage at the left? And people know this. People recognize this, and that's why I think we're so fractured.
Yeah, no, that is the fundamental problem that I try and... Well, first of all, I lay out why it's the way it is in the book, and then I talk about how Trump was able to take advantage of that. And then towards the end of the book, without being too prescriptive, I try and point people to a potential, the beginning of the solution, which is simply to venture out and start listening to what other people are saying. Not to agree with it, just to know what they're saying so that your reality doesn't get overturned all over again.
And hold that for just a minute, because this is the big Gulliver's Travels thought with which you end the book. And let's take a little break, and then we'll come back and you'll have time to really lay it out. Brooke Gladstone with us, Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with our On the Media co-host and managing editor, Brooke Gladstone, author of a brand new short book called The Trouble with Reality, A Rumination on Moral Panic in Our Time. It's an 87-page essay, and it draws on cultural and literary figures from Hannah Arendt to Walter Lippmann, George Orwell, Philip K. Dick, Ursula K. Le Guin, Jonathan Swift, to name a few, to help us understand what the heck is going on with this twisted moment in our history after the election of Donald Trump. And I will throw in again that we are giving away signed copies of The Trouble with Reality to the first 120 people this hour who call up and join WNYC at the $15 a month sustaining membership level. This is a little prelude to our spring pledge drive, which, except for this, will start tomorrow. but if you want to pledge right now and get a signed copy of Brooke's book, The Trouble with Reality, for a $15 sustaining membership, $15 a month, that's 888-376-WNYC, 888-376-9692, or you can do it online just as easily at WNYC.org. Thank you all for supporting the station.
You know, I was told by a number of people who have read the book that although there isn't a solution and I'm not trying to calm anybody down, just placing this moment in a historical perspective offers a kind of consolation. You realize we've been here before as a species, even as a nation, and the Republic survived. So there's that. I have that going for me anyway.
I had that experience reading the book too. It's somehow at once comforting and activating to see the intellectual context and the deep thinking that you did and research to give us the deep historical, sort of the intellectually historical, or the history of political philosophy that underlies why we are where we are right now. I actually put this in the context of Gail Collins' appearance here too before. We had that caller complaining about Gail, and we had one when she was here complaining that she still uses a lot of humor in her column when it's not a funny moment. And it's not a funny moment. But I think it's important to remember, this is just my opinion, that you know, at the darkest moments of Soviet totalitarianism, humor was a main bulwark against the state for both the psychological survival of individuals and their families and for resistance. So I think, you know.
And we're a long way from there. But it's certainly true. Giving up humor, I mean, doesn't that mean then that your opponents, whoever they may be, win?
Anyway, you conclude this book by saying activism is not enough. You have to travel out of your moral comfort zone into the world of others. And after your book has referenced all these cultural touchstones, Orwell, Hannah Arendt, John Adams, Ursula Gwynne, Walter Lippmann, Huxley's Brave New World, the final cultural reference in the book is Gulliver's Travels by Jonathan Swift. Why Gulliver's Travels, and that we are the irrational Yahoo people from that story, not the the logical horses of that story governed by reason?
It was trying to understand the value in what we do in our world creation, that we can't live as the horses did, the hermonymes or whatever their names were, these gloriously rational horses that had really no familial feeling, no religion, no art, no storytelling, no vanity. They were pure rationality, and it's a cold, cold life. They never reflected on their lives. When it was time to die, they trotted off to die, and that was that. Humans don't live that way. They have to weave the seen and the known with the unseen and the unknown to create a more complete world. And the Yahoos were the most primal lizard-brained id, Cro-Magnon type expression of that. They were nothing but impulse. It was like the whole human being divided in two parts. And then there was a third inhabitant of the realms that Gulliver traveled that I'd completely forgotten about, which were the Laputans. And these were philosophers of science who lived on an island floating in the sky. And literally, they can't see straight. One eye is focused up, one eye is focused down. And they had to hire people to gently strike them on the mouth, strike the mouth of the man who was supposed to speak and the ear of the one who was supposed to listen, and to hold on to his master so that he didn't just walk into the street or fall down a hole, because they were so detached from the world in their speculations. And they didn't know how to work in the world at all. They built lopsided homes, clothes that didn't make sense. They were so oblivious to the results and so smugly ensured of their own superiority that they were both quite brilliant and quite stupid. And that's what happens when you focus on abstraction and systems and don't continually refresh your view of the world that you actually live in, which means stepping out of the unseen creation into what you can see, and not just what you can see around you, but what you, with the help of our endless media, our boundless ability to peer elsewhere, read into the minds of other people who are so utterly foreign to you.
And that's ultimately in this rumination that your book is on unshared realities that strikes many pessimistic notes.
Mm-hmm.
You conclude that there is a path, maybe not to agreement, but at least to comprehension. And so the last line of your book is, if we really look, we might see that other reality reflected in that person's eyes. And therein lies the beginning of the end of our reality problem. So you're not such a pessimistic fatalist after all.
Hey, I mean, you have a choice. You can give up or you can keep striving. I mean, all of the people who are calling in saying we must resist must understand that there is an external resistance, but there's also a resistance one can wage against one's own smug surety, our own tunnel vision, not that it even has to change you, but so that you really know what you're fighting against and how best to know what you're fighting for.
We just have 2 minutes left. How did you manage to write this book
in 2 weeks?
Yeah, I mean, this is obviously since the election, since the inauguration.
Mm-hmm. I didn't start it until February. Workman Publishing gets a lot of credit. They suggested that On the Media do something, and I said there's not a thing that we could do over a length of time that wouldn't come out until the fall, and by then the country will have changed 100 times over. We have to get this out in the spring, which means I finished it in March. So it was a very fast turnaround. It was kind of a fever dream. Basically, I wanted to address those anxious, gut-wrenching feelings that I would occasionally have until I could compartmentalize them for the work. Then I let Bob experience those feelings instead.
Your co-host, Bob Garfield.
But this whole thing was to stare it down. And the way that I do that is to step away, as far away as I can get, and look at it from a distance and see where it fits in to everything else we know about ourselves.
And so I'll just wrap it up by mentioning one more time that our spring pledge drive begins tomorrow, but just this hour as a special pre-pledge drive offer in honor of Brooke as our guest today and the publication of this new book, The Trouble with Reality. We have a special offer right now when you make a sustaining contribution of $15 a month to WNYC. We have 120 signed copies to give away, and I haven't been getting updates on how many are left, but I imagine there's one for you if you are one of the first 120 listeners. In fact, Brooke, you will promise that if we are going over 120, you'll sign however many we get in by noon, right?
Of course I will. And Brian, I'm so grateful that you liked it so much. I can't tell you. Thank
you. I really
you.
Love it. And I really do think it's intellectually deep and inspirational, emotionally and sort of culturally enlightening, all of those things at the same time. So if you wanted Brooke Gladstone signed copy of The Trouble with Reality, A Rumination on Moral Panic in Our Time, you can get one on WNYC.org with a $15 a month membership in WNYC or call 888-376-WNYC, 888-376-9692. Enough said about that. Thanks for your support, everybody. And Brooke, congratulations on an amazing accomplishment.
Thank you, Brian. And I'll be happy to sign any book that anybody wants, even if I didn't write it.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Talk to you tomorrow.